Welcome to the Jack Straw Writers Program, a series of live readings and conversations with Pacific Northwest writers, recorded during the spring of 2005 at Jack Straw Productions in Seattle. This year's series was curated and hosted by John Mifsud. In this program, we will hear from poet Carlos Martinez and writer Nian Nguyen. Here's your host, John Mifsud.
Carlos Martinez teaches literature and creative writing at Western Washington University. He's been published locally in Cranky, Crab Creek Review, Poets West Literary Journal, Jeopardy, and Fourth Street. Nationally, he is published in Morpo Review, The Pittsburgh Quarterly, Black Bear Review, Poet Lore, and Firefly. In 2003, Mr. Martinez took second prize in the America's Review Poetry Contest. His chapbook, The Cold Music of the Ocean, was published in August 2004. Please help me welcome Carlos Martinez.
Thank you for that lovely introduction, and thank you for having picked me for this honor. And thanks to the people at Jack Straw, and thanks to all of you for being here this evening. I'm going to more or less read the poems in the order that they appear in the chapbook. And the first one's dedicated to two very good friends of mine, the poets Jim Bertolino and Anita Boyle, and it's called Ontology. And ontology is one of the disciplines of philosophical inquiry. The arpeggio of the wind stirs the fire. Flames leap. Some say they dance and caper, pushing darkness away with fevered hands. Beyond the light that moves out to meet the light from Sirius, shapes move. They slide. They slither against the grease of shadow. This is night, where everything hidden becomes itself, especially eyes, the redness at the back of them, behind the vitreous fluid. Sometimes we think it possible to see into the brain, watch synapses fire. It's not possible. Each smooth skull is a round basin in which water laves desire. Imagine if we could see the world, even vegetarians would pass out. It's too bad about Adam and Eve. In bedrooms all over the world, we become naked all over again. In orchards, fruit drowses while it waits. Even apples dream. Even pomegranates and figs aspire to burst from their skins. There are people, and I know quite a few of them, who don't like poems about poetry or about poems. But I do. This is called Between the Formal and the Open. In the absence of rhyme, how does one begin to discuss time's passage, either swift or slow, or how light glows from the sky or refracts from skyscraper windows, how the afterglow of day gives way to pitch dark night during a power outage, or how lovers, once done, congregate back inside themselves and pass a smile off as being sufficient. Without those certain words we love for euphony, call it music. The musical touch of the tongue as short baton we wield on the podium of who we are. Here discordant notes, the ineptly executed passage. How can anything then become as lovely as a song by Whitney Houston or Beyoncé? Divas born to rapture. As when the poet stirs in the morning and sips the first cup of coffee, lights the first cigarette, aroma of smoke as intoxicating as illegal weed. What is he or she to write, to read out loud in the bathroom, acoustics perfect. That's where you should read. Law, say the gardeners, is the sun. Law is whatever needs to be done to bring alive and kicking anything that shines and glimmers when we see it. Rhyme or open form? That's the question. The chorus in the back room of who I am chooses the proper notes, the wrinkled sheet of music I need to use. You choose, too, what you need.
Carlos Martinez with curator John Mifsud.
How does inspiration come to you?
Oh, it's all inspiration. It just comes. What was it that Randall Jarrell said? He said, a poet is an individual who walks out into a thunderstorm hoping to be hit by lightning. And I think that very well describes what my process is. I don't try to force things to happen, but I allow myself to be open to whatever it is that strikes me in a certain way that will generate that first line. And that first line will generate the second line, which generates the third, which generates the fourth, et cetera.
So what gets that passionate circle of energy going for you?
Getting lost in the words. I mean, once I start writing, as I described it once to in one of my workshops when I was in graduate school, I'm not there for that first draft. The reality is that it is happening, and the ego, the me, has stepped back. And I'm not present and conscious until I begin the revision process, which is very focused. It's not automatic writing. I wouldn't describe it as that because I do try and guide and control, but I don't try and dominate the process. I let the flow happen as it happens, and just to see what happens, what comes out. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it works, and a lot of times it just plain doesn't. But I think that's true of a lot of writing anyway.
Let's return to the studio with Carlos Martinez.
I'm going to admit for the first time in public that, in fact, I do write a lot of erotic poetry, the majority of which has titles like, Oh, Baby, Baby. But not this particular poem. Come see me again. This is called The Currency We Earn. There are the wages that are paid, the coins, small and hard, the coins a few but bright and smooth, faces stamped into them, faces to be remembered, faces that evoke the rest of the bodies, evoke memories of nights in rooms with lamps fitted with 40-watt bulbs, so that shadows came and rested on everything. Between wet shoulder blades like wings, in the hollows of stomachs, in the basins of the pelvis that speak of dusk, twilight, fading light, of wandering across dew-wet grass, where sometimes you would sing, head thrown back, neck muscles as taut, as bridge cable, as bright. Those are the wages, the little you've earned through the honest labor of your hips, and how you dreamt they were pistons, engines of transcendence. Here, let me become a part of you. The clink of coins in deep pockets, where a hand might reach to touch and fondle spare change while walking home from someone's hot room where she, whoever she is, lies in her bed, peignoir fresh from the wash, soft and flowing, her thighs, as they slide against each other, a form of mellifluous speech. I grew up in New York City, in Spanish Harlem. And to most people, if they bother to think of it at all, it's a horrible place. It's a slum. It's a ghetto. But to me, it was home. This is called When It Snowed in Spanish Harlem. I'll close with this. It was thick and deep enough, we pretended we were in Siberia, or stranded for the long season at the South Pole. We stumbled, we floundered, fell, got up again to look at the inscrutable horizon, wondering if help would come, dog sleds piled high, with clothing, with hot food. We bundled up before we left our tenements, so that when we stepped into the cold wind coming from downtown canyons, we felt warm. Wool mittens, wool hats with ear flaps, two pairs of pants, boots that took 10 minutes for our mothers to buckle. Small brown children whose veins shrieked with tropical heat, we ran from the dark tenement hallways into towering drifts, laughing. Thank you.
Carlos Martinez reading as part of the Jack Straw Writers Program. Our program continues with Nien Nguyen. Nien Nguyen with curator John Mifsud.
What I've been working on for the past couple years now is looking at sort of the difference between being Americanized Vietnamese and being someone who is Vietnamese living in America. And that kind of difference is subtle yet very, very different. And so a lot of my work recently has been about what happens when those two types of people come together and try and form some kind of relationship together, some sort of understanding. And so it's a lot about something that is shared but not shared.
Once again, John Misood.
Nhien Nguyen was born in Nha Trang, Vietnam, and grew up in Portland, Oregon. She is currently the editor-in-chief of the International Examiner, a news journal for Asian American communities here in the Northwest. And she has completed her first fiction novel about being Vietnamese American and received both the Seattle Arts Commission Literary Award in 2002, as well as the Seattle City Artists Literary Project Award. Please help me welcome Nhien Nguyen.
So this is a part of a larger body of work called Transitions. Paul scrunched his round face, making the bags under his eyes into moon crescents. Tonight, the cringe was not from the meal of kung pao chicken, left over from last night's Chinese takeout, but from the sound of Mary's fork scraping her teeth. "Could you not do that?" Paul said, cupping his hands over his ears. Mary apologized, though she was not truly sorry for the way she ate her food. Since age 8, she had learned from Morgan Fairchild tips on how to eat while at the same time keeping your lipstick intact. Roll spaghetti tightly on your fork and pull the fork out of your mouth with your teeth, not your lips, was the example Morgan gave on the talk show. Mary couldn't remember which. 8 years later, when she began wearing makeup, she realized that Morgan's tricks worked. Little did she know that such an unconscious habit would be the greatest pet peeve of her husband of 2 years. These days, however, Mary made the sound that grated Paul's ears on purpose, even exaggerated it. For it was the only time during dinner that Paul said anything to her. She had resorted to hiding the chopsticks just so she could make the metal screech sound with their utensils. In the past 6 months, Paul and Mary Tran spoke few words during their half hour that they were together at dinner. At other times at home in their loft, they managed to be in separate areas away from each other. A laptop made it possible for Paul to move his workstation wherever Mary was not. Since there were no doors to divide the room, Mary could still see Paul hunched over his laptop, working on QuickBooks or reading books he downloaded off the internet. She became quite skilled at watching for the twitch of Paul's spiky black hair just as he moved to glance over his shoulder. She quickly resumed what she was doing and didn't look his way again until she heard the clicking of the keyboard keys. Mary took their plates, his with half-eaten bites of chicken and broccoli, hers wiped clean, to the kitchen sink. Before she began on the dishes, she tied her hair back, annoyed by the hair tickling her shoulders. Her regular haircut every 6 weeks had been overdue for 2 weeks now. "Paul, can you bring the rest of the dishes to the kitchen?" Mary said. Paul had parked himself in front of the television, within range of her voice, though the room was filled with white noise from the McDonald's commercial. Mary crept behind the couch and peered at the screen of his computer. Dark black pupils stared back at her. It was her mother-in-law's eyes zoomed in. Mary could tell by the way Paul was transfixed on diffusing the bloodshot red in the whites of her eyes. Paul's mother, Rose, had died last year in a sudden heart attack. She was 1 week shy of her 60th birthday. The photo, as Paul returned it to its undistorted shape, was one of the last taken of Rose in the hospital. "Paul?" The room was silent. Paul and Mary moved into her loft 1 month after their wedding. They had been engaged for almost a year and a half, and during the extended wedding planning, Mary had searched for their first apartment. "It will be fun," Mary insisted every Sunday since Paul proposed, using a different strategy to drag Paul along. "We can check out some vacancies in Magnolia and then take a walk in Discovery Park." "Not today," Paul said every time. "You go on ahead. I trust your opinion." This was their ritual during their engagement. Mary came to visit Paul, who, at age 30, lived with his mother in a two-bedroom house, of which Paul had the basement to himself. The excuses for not joining Mary on the apartment search range from work to gardening, neither of which he really did. In the end, Paul spent his Sundays at home, chopping vegetables or cutting the meat to help his mother prepare a feast for the week. One Sunday, instead of retiring to her studio after a couple of hours attending open houses, Mary had found the perfect duplex in Crown Hill, just blocks from her Safeway and minutes from a donut shop, her one vice of an otherwise vigorous nutritional diet. Mary, her face red with enthusiasm, came bounding into Paul's house. "Paul," she said, grabbing his hand moist from rinsing cilantro, "you must come to see this place. You'll fall in love with it, I promise." "Paul?" Rose's high-toned voice broke through Mary's next words. The mother-son team must have been preparing a special dish, for Rose was ready for combat with a red bandana around her forehead. "The pork skin is near crisp that could break a tooth," she said in Vietnamese. Paul nudged Mary's elbow. "Oh," Mary said, forgetting to greet Rose formally. "Chào bác?" Rose nodded her head in acknowledgement, and her gaze resumed to her son's. With one look, Rose returned to the kitchen. "Dinner is almost ready," Paul said. "Why don't you stay? My mother wouldn't mind, I'm sure." "But they'll only be showing the place for another hour. There were several people interested. That duplex will be gone, for sure." "There's no rush, Mary. This place doesn't work out. There will be others." No rush was Paul's way of delaying things he did not want to face. When he was unemployed, there was no reason to rush into a job he did not like. When it was time to set a date for the wedding, there was no rush since they would have a lifetime together. "My mom always warms up to you when you eat her food, and enjoy it," Paul said with a gentle tone. He never let Mary forget the time she spat out the congealed blood, which she mistook as a chunk of beef in her bowl of pho. She had to make it up to Rose ever since. "But Paul," Mary said, her lips in a pout. Mary called the landlord that evening after the meal. The duplex was snatched up in an hour after Mary had seen the place. As the wedding date was postponed from May to June to September, Mary discovered the loft a month before their wedding, and though she paid the deposit and first and last month's rent before Paul saw the place, they did not move in until a month after their nuptials. The frogs in the lake behind the trans complex croaked their midnight symphony. Mary could not imagine falling asleep without the frogs in the background to fill the pounding sound of silence in the darkness. "Is it time already for that?" Paul said when Mary nuzzled her face at the back of her husband's neck. Mary flipped onto her stomach and took half the sheets with her. "I didn't mean it like that. I'm just surprised that a month has passed. Where does the time go?" Paul said quickly. "Forget it. We don't have to." Paul put his chin on the back of her shoulder. "No, we should do it. Your eggs are ready to crack open. Come on, climb on top of me." Mary let go of the weight of her body to Paul's lift onto his chest and stomach. Paul and Mary had been trying to conceive a child for over a year. Since Mary had met Paul, she had looked forward to having a son they would name Peter. Their friends got a kick out of the thought of knowing a Peter, Paul, and Mary, and had urged them to get married and have kids the moment they became a couple. They had begun the effort to get Mary pregnant with ease until Rose died. Their first year of courtship was an exhilarating time of Paul sneaking out of his house to have sex with her at her apartment. She hated the fact that his mother expected him home at night and in the morning. After an hour of lovemaking at midnight, he left the nerves of her body to tingle on through the night on its own devices. After the thrill reminiscent of high school rebellion wore off, Mary began to wonder that the pressure for Paul to be home was not from his mother, but of his own choosing. She hoped, and expected, that marriage, prompting Paul to move out of her mother's house, was the answers to the barriers of their intimacy. The bed creaked as Paul turned her over on her back and rubbed his groin against hers. "Paul, remember how we broke the bed frame when we first moved in?" Mary said softly in his ear. The first night at Newlyweds, in their own loft, separate from the world, had been a passionate night of freedom. 3 months followed of similar levels of intensity, prompting them to leave the possibility of pregnancy to chance. Paul laughed under his breath in recognition of the memory when he made a flying leap on top of her, breaking the wood frame of their queen-sized bed. That was when he weighed more from the bulked-up muscles of regular weightlifting and devouring the food he had cooked himself for dinner. Feeling the weight of him now, Paul was light as rice paper. His once toned forearms were perhaps comparable to her weak limbs. She rubbed his arms up and down as if her rough touch could spark the growth of flesh on his bones. "I still remember you had to lie to my brother that we broke it during the move. We couldn't keep a straight face the entire time he was fixing it," she giggled at the image in her mind. For a moment, with Paul kissing her neck, Mary thought they might have a night with at least half the fervor of the times when they first moved into the loft. She planted her lips on his. The shock of the plush flesh reminded her that they had not shared a passionate kiss since his mother died. He pulled back as if he was awakened from a state of disregard of the chasm between them these last few months. And then they continued through to the end of the sex, as they did to make a baby. Neither of them knew if they wanted any more. They were two strangers who shared the same loft, the same bed, inside each other, yet never further apart.
Nian Nguyen, reading as part of the Jack Straw Writers Program. These readings and interviews were recorded at Jack Straw Productions during the spring of 2005 as part of the Jack Straw Writers Program and co-produced for radio with KUOW-FM. The curator of this year's program was John Mifsud. Audio engineer and producer for radio was Scott Bartlett. The program's manager was Steve Peters. The executive director of Jack Straw Productions is Joan Rabinowitz. The Jack Straw Writers Program is made possible with support from the Paul G. Allen Family Foundation for the Arts, the Brenneman Jake Foundation, Arts Fund, the Mayor's Office of Arts and Cultural Affairs, the For Culture King County Lodging Tax Fund, the Washington State Arts Commission, the National Endowment for the Arts, Humanities Washington, and individual contributors. Support for radio production provided by Clark Neuber, Certified Public Accountants and Consultants. Original music provided by Jack Straw Artist-in-Residence, Ila Lamlin. All of the writers heard in this series are published in Volume 9 of the Jack Straw Writers Anthology and featured online in the Jack Straw Writers Forum at jackstraw.org. To purchase a copy of the anthology or for more information about Jack Straw Productions or the Jack Straw Writers Program, please contact us by phone at 206-634-0919. Or visit us at www.jackstraw.org. Thanks for listening.